This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. And in today's program, we review SCOTUS, the latest rulings from the Supreme Court of the United States. Earlier, the court made rulings restricting some provisions of Arizona's anti-immigrant legislation. The court also ruled that life without parole mandatory sentencing for juveniles is unconstitutional. We'll be speaking about those things. We'll be joined by Brendan Fisher of PR Watch, also John Bonifaz of Free Speech for People, about the Citizens United ruling that also came out from the Supreme Court. And we'll also speak with Jennifer Lowenstein of the University of Wisconsin about the political changes in Egypt. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight, and today was a very busy one for the Supreme Court with some major rulings on the anti-immigration legislation in Arizona that would put the state at an equal level of immigration enforcement as the federal government. The court ruled on that and did let stand for the time being the show your papers provision of that law. In addition, the court ruled on Citizens United and on mandatory life without parole sentencing for juveniles. And one of the things that has not been perhaps completely addressed is the hidden hand on this pro-prison and anti-immigrant legislation. The Arizona law is similar to many other bills that have been produced in state legislatures under the aegis of the organization ALEC, the American Legislative Executive Council. And we're now joined live by Brendan Fisher of PR Watch, who has been very much studying the effect of this clandestine arm of national legislation. Welcome to 5 o'clock shadow, Brendan.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, let's just start with how unique is the Arizona legislation?
So it is based off of a model that was approved by the corporate and legislative members of the American Legislative Exchange Council. Arizona was the first law to actually pass it, but then after that you saw it spread across the country. You saw versions of the law introduced in multiple states and become law in at least five other states.
So there are clones and carbon copies of this legislation with similar wording?
Yes, variations in each state, but they all seem to have similar provisions, similar wording, and in many cases a similar impact and effect.
The laws about the immigration control by the state, usurping federal prerogative on that, are these legislative efforts confined to the southern rim states of the United States? Are there similar pieces of legislation at the Canadian border? Just how widespread is this this clandestine effort?
They do seem to be primarily in the southern states, but the anti-immigrant sentiment really has swept across the country. And Alabama also has a law similar to this one that actually is even more extreme. It goes even further than the Arizona law. Utah, Indiana, Georgia, and South Carolina are the other states that have passed laws. We're based in Wisconsin. A legislator here did introduce the bill. His concern was not about Canadians crossing the border. It was very much about more Latinos emigrating to Wisconsin.
This legislation provides for the state to basically take the word of a police or law enforcement officer as to thinking that somebody might just hypothetically be an undocumented worker or immigrant. What kind of problems does that raise for racism, profiling, and discrimination?
Yeah, it creates all sorts of problems. At the very basis of it, how can you tell if a person is an undocumented immigrant? And in many states and in many cases, the way that a law enforcement officer is going to make that determination is going to be based on someone's skin color, and maybe based on their accent. And that just opens the door for racial profiling. It opens the door for people getting harassed by law enforcement without having done anything wrong, and with no reasonable basis for that harassment. And it goes further than that. It makes it necessary for even American citizens to have to carry paperwork showing that they are citizens in case they're stopped by law enforcement. And it also includes provisions that prevent law enforcement from deciding that they don't want to waste all of their resources focusing on tracking down immigrants who may not have done anything else wrong. It actually creates civil liability for law enforcement officers that decide that they don't want to focus their limited resources on tracking down immigrants. So if a law enforcement officer or a police department decides that they would rather focus on more important crimes, on finding rapists or murderers, someone in their community can actually bring a lawsuit and hold them accountable for not following the letter of the law.
Brendan Fisher is a law fellow and a reporter with PR Watch. And I think the specification of this law as applying to immigrants, and if someone is arbitrarily rounded up, that they would have to stay in prison for an additional document search and documentation, this seems to go beyond people of a darker hue, because that means that police would be given, under this carbon copy clone type of legislation, the ability to pretty much stop anyone, and people who consider themselves white would ultimately find themselves ensnared by this presumption of guilt, would they not?
Yeah, it does. It does open the door to that. And I mean, they did write into law that law enforcement officers are not permitted to use race as a deciding factor in choosing whether to stop someone or inquire into their immigration status. But you know, that's that really open with that provision. It really opens the door for using almost any factor, and it just opens the door for police officers to have way too much discretion to stop people and to interfere with the way that we go about our daily lives.
Well, there was a time when Europeans were illegal immigrants on this continent.
Yeah, well, there still certainly are plenty of undocumented immigrants from Europe. Most of the press pays attention to immigrants from South America and Mexico, but They come from all parts.
Brendan, you are the author of a very important article at PR Watch and the Center for Media and Democracy titled "The Profit Motive Underlies the Outbreak of Immigration Bills." Can you take us deeper into the financial interest, the prison industry, the way that it's about money in addition to xenophobia?
Yeah. So this is really the basis of this law. Obviously, there's been a wave of anti-immigrant sentiment that's, for the most part, motivated by xenophobia, motivated by a concern about more Latinos in communities. And so Arizona Senator Russell Pierce came up with the idea for this law. He tried introducing it for several years. It was blocked. It was vetoed 1 year by Janet Napolitano, and then he brought it to the American Legislative Exchange Council, and he brought it to the Public Safety and Elections Task Force of ALEC, and members of that ALEC task force included the Corrections Corporation of America, which is the world's largest private prison operator. And why that's important is because around half of all immigrant detention facilities are operated by private corporations, by private prison corporations. And the way that they make more money is by having more people behind bars. So if by bypassing this law and getting more people rounded up, getting more people pushed into the immigration system and detained in private prisons, private prison operators like Corrections Corporation of America to make more money.
The other ruling of significance from the Supreme Court today stated that under the terms of the Eighth Amendment regarding due process and cruel and unusual punishment, that it is improper for there to be laws for mandatory life sentences without parole for minors, for people under the age of 18 across the United States. Does that, with the three strikes and you're in jail law, do these two things factor into what you're speaking about, the financial interests for such repressive legislation and prison building?
Yeah. And Corrections Corporation of America has been a member of ALEC for a long time. They said that they suspended their membership in late in late 2010 or early 2011. But they had been members since at least the early 1990s, perhaps the late 1980s. So with their membership, they were part of an organization that passed more laws to put more people in prison for more time. The two key laws were the three strikes you're out law, which put more people in prison for more time if they were to commit three separate crimes, and the truth in sentencing law, which meant that people were in prison for more time, that the sentence that you were given, that you it takes away all opportunities for early release or for release based on good behavior. It took away the incentives for people who are in prison to take advantage of some of the programs that might help them, put them on the route to rehabilitation, with the incentive of getting out early. So this led to just an explosion in the prison population since the 90s when these laws were introduced. And at the same time, ALEC was pushing laws to privatize prisons. So at the same time that they were putting more people in prison for more time, they were putting more of these people behind bars in facilities that were operated by private corporations. And so the same organizations that were part of ALEC and promoting these laws and having a hand in getting them approved as model bills were also standing to benefit from their passage and to benefit financially.
With the anti-immigrant legislation in Arizona and elsewhere as promulgated by ALEC, and the way that immigrant workers have been a cornerstone of maintaining the service industry and a very important part of the American economy, agricultural work and so on, the attempt to round them up under specious encounters seems to be a way of putting them all in one place, imprison them, and then have them work for the CoreCorp, the corrections profiteers of the prison inmates.
Yeah, and that is another piece of what ALEC has been pushing. They've been seeking to expand the use of prison labor. And, you know, I don't know that immigrants would necessarily be involved in prison labor, but other prisoners, people who are convicted of other crimes under the criminal justice code as opposed to the immigration laws, they're getting put to work to essentially compete with private industry. And, you know, we outlawed that many years ago for the reason that it's essentially slavery. You don't want to incentivize getting more people behind bars because you want cheap labor.
Brendan Fisher is a law fellow at PR Watch, and you and your colleagues' work over at alecexposed.org have been doing a tremendous job on the shadow government. This legislative council appears to be almost like a fourth branch of government, bringing forward de facto national legislation by bypassing the federal legislative branch and having these cloned carbon copy laws all across the country. And we're so very grateful for your research on that. And can you now give us an up-to-the-minute survey of the pushback against ALEC and these repressive and racist and profiteering laws?
Yeah, there's been a real exodus of corporate and legislative members from ALEC since more light has shone on the organization, since the public has been beginning to see what ALEC really stands for. A number of their corporate and legislative members have left. Just this week, Dell Computers left ALEC. They were the 21st corporation to leave in the past months, and that makes them the 25th private sector member of ALEC. So, in addition to about 20 corporations, there were four foundations and nonprofits that have also dropped their ALEC membership. And there's been about 55 legislators across the country who have announced that they're no longer going to participate in ALEC meetings. They're no longer going to be a member of ALEC.
Who are some of the remaining members that people might think are liberal, progressive, or have a good corporate image? What are some of the ongoing, continuing sustainers of this group?
So the big two that we've been focusing on, we being the Center for Media and Democracy, along with Color of Change, Common Cause, People for the American Way, and others, we're focusing on State Farm. State Farm Insurance, which projects an image of being a friendly company. They try and brand themselves as being a good neighbor, but they're not being a good neighbor if they're funding an organization that's promoting laws like Arizona's SB 1070 law, or promoting laws like the Stand Your Ground law that was at issue in the Trayvon Martin shooting in Florida. So we're trying to get people to ask State Farm to drop their ALEC membership. Another thing about ALEC is that they get 98% of their funding from their corporate members and from their foundation members. So without that corporate funding, they can't advance their agenda. They can't advance laws like Arizona's SB 1070 law. So we're asking State Farm to follow the lead of Dell Computers, of Johnson & Johnson, Walmart, Coca-Cola, all corporations that have left ALEC in recent months, and to dump ALEC. The other corporation that we're focusing on is AT&T.
Have you been in touch with them? Are they saying why they're continuing to
There've been ongoing conversations and different campaigns. They haven't exactly said why they are retaining their membership. So they may be waiting to see if this is all going to blow over. There's been a slow, steady trickle of corporations that have been leaving in recent months, some of which have been involved in ALEC for a long time. But Walmart was a big one. They've been involved in ALEC for many years. They were on the governing private enterprise board, same with Johnson & Johnson and Coca-Cola. So I think the more that these corporations realize that this campaign is not a flash in the pan, that people, as more and more people begin to realize what ALEC is and what it does and what it stands for, they realize that they don't want their consumer dollars going to fund this organization. They don't want to support a corporation that's going to turn around and use their consumer dollars to push laws like SB 1070.
Supported by corporations like AT&T and State Farm Insurance. How can people be in touch and be involved in the campaign, Brendan?
You can visit our website, alecexposed.org. So there we have a lot of information about what ALEC is, which legislators are members of ALEC, which remaining corporations are ALEC members. We have links to petitions to ask the remaining corporate members to drop their ALEC membership. And we have links to a number of different articles and that sort of thing where you can find out more and get more involved.
Well, thank you for being with us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. Very revealing research that you've been doing, and the best to all of your colleagues.
All right, thank you.
Brendan Fisher, this is 5 O'Clock Shadow. We'll be back with more.
So welcome, welcome, emigrante, to my country. Welcome home. Welcome, welcome, emigrante, to the country that I love. I am proud, I am proud of my forefathers, and I say they built this country. And they came from far away, poor land they didn't know, the same way you do, my friend. So welcome, welcome, emigrante, to my country. Welcome home, welcome, welcome, emigrante, to the country that I love. I am proud, I am proud of my forefathers, and I sing about their courage, for they spoke a foreign language and they labored with their hands the same way you do, my friend. So welcome, welcome, emigrante, to my country. Welcome home, welcome, welcome, emigrante, to the country that I love. And I sing about their patience, for the work they did was lowly, and they dirtied up their clothes. They spoke a foreign language, and they labored with their hands, and they came from far away to a land they didn't know, the same way you do, my friend.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow, that Buffy St. Marie of the Cree Nation. My name is Robert Knight, and there were other decisions from the Supreme Court, in particular in regard to the so-called Citizens United case, and the court seemed to indicate today that it has no intention, at least in the foreseeable future, to roll back the role of corporate contributions in political campaigns. In a 5-4 decision, the court struck down a century-old Montana state law that banned corporations from spending any of their cash to support or oppose a candidate or a political party. To get a deeper look at this, we're now joined by John Bonifaz. He is the executive director of Free Speech for People. Can you tell us the significance of today's decision?
Yes, and thank you for having me. You know, this is an extraordinary ruling, a radical ruling, as radical as the Citizens United ruling was 2.5 years ago, which opened the floodgates for unlimited corporate money in our elections, and which swept away a century of precedent that had barred corporations from having any role in our elections. And in the face of overwhelming evidence that the basic premise of the Citizens United ruling was wrong, 5 justices of the United States Supreme Court today said they do not care. They do not care about the facts. They do not care that 2 years of experience under the Citizens United ruling have demonstrated that independent expenditures from corporations and mega-wealthy individuals threaten the integrity of our elections, and they do not care about the devastating impact of their ruling on our democracy. So the answer must be now that we, the people, use our powers under the Constitution, Article 5, to amend the Constitution, to overrule the Supreme Court, and to make clear that we, the people, rule, not we, the corporations. We've done this before in our nation's history, 27 times before, 7 times to overturn egregious Supreme Court rulings. And this is one of those moments in our nation's history where we must do that again. And at freespeechforpeople.org, we're involved in helping to lead that movement, having been launched the day of the Citizens United ruling, and clearly more determined than ever as a result of today's ruling to continue that fight.
There was an oddity in the announcement of today's split decision 5-4 that did not involve the dissenting members of this ruling from requiring a review. Can you tell us the significance of that acquiescence?
Well, Justice Breyer wrote a dissenting opinion for the other 3 justices, and Kagan, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor. And what he said in that dissenting opinion was that if it were up to him, he would have granted review and would have, you know, of course, had the court review these facts 2.5 years later after Citizens United. But what happened in the majority opinion, which was a per curiam opinion where no one identifies who wrote it, and it was a one-page opinion, and it basically said that nothing had changed since Citizens United in their view, and therefore there was no need to review this case on the merits. In light of that, Justice Breyer said that he would have denied review on the grounds that accepting review would have clearly resulted in a 5-4 ruling, again, upholding Citizens United. You know, I think that this was an opportunity, frankly, for the dissent to be stronger in their language in challenging the majority. But this is, you know, how Justice Breyer came out. It is also true that had there been a denial of review and the 5 justices having gone along with that would have allowed Montana and every other state in the union to experiment with campaign spend limits again on corporate spending. And so it's clear that the 5 justices weren't going to go there either. They wanted to quickly reverse this case and get rid of it. They did not want the embarrassment of the spotlight being shined on them again in this election cycle with all the damage that they've wrought on our democracy. So they summarily reversed, which is the term used for a quick reversal without a ruling on the merits. And it's exceedingly rare for that to happen with a state Supreme Court ruling being at issue. And that's what this was. A Montana Supreme Court had upheld the law, and here the U.S. Supreme Court was was striking down the law without even reviewing the state Supreme Court ruling on the merits.
John Bonifaz is the executive director of Free Speech for People. And there has always been corporate bribery, business bribery in American electoral politics. Also, always the backdoor payments, payment of expenses, or the revolving door in which politicians are given a boon after their public service on behalf of the corporations who pay for their campaigns and their elections. So they formed the Federal Election Commission, which purportedly reports on some donations to the various candidates. But it seems to me there are so many loopholes, the way in which individuals all from the same company each give the maximum documentable donation to a candidate, the political action committees. Can you paint a picture for us of just how deep corporate money is in the electoral process in the United States?
Well, you know, you're right that there's a long history here of corporations trying to effectively interfere with our elections. Having said that, I think that this decision of Citizens United dramatically changes the landscape. I mean, it is true that corporations have tried through the back door in other ways to do this, but really for a century we've blocked corporate spending in our elections directly, and that now is opened up. I mean, you know, we literally have the ability of the Exxons and the Chevrons and the Bank of Americas to come in and spend their general treasury dollars in our elections, drowning out any semblance of ordinary citizen voices. But there is a long history here, certainly, that you know, goes before that century of precedent, in which you know we've seen major corporate actors try to control our democracy. And that's really what this history was present in this case. I mean, the Copper Kings controlled the state of Montana in the early 20th century. They ran elections there, they ran the politics, they ran the government. And so the people of Montana responded with a ballot initiative in 1912 to put on the ballot the Corrupt Practices Act. They passed that initiative. They created a law that barred corporate influence, corporate spending in elections. And a century later, we're now switching back to the early 20th century, and we're allowing those kinds of copper kings, you know, the new financial kings of this century to rule. And that's I think, the danger that faces our republic. It really is a moment in our history where we have to stand up and defend our republican democracy and demand a constitutional amendment to overrule the court.
What are people doing to make others more aware of how imprisoned the thinking is when the television screens, the radios are filled with simple-minded attack ads or mythologies of xenophobia and race and reactionary politics, or the empty trumpetings of small accomplishments? How do people get an antidote to this kind of corporate-funded barrage?
Yes, well, it's a great question. I'd urge people to join us at freespeechforpeople.org. There will be plenty of antidotes there to hear about this growing movement. We also launched today with Common Cause, electionsareforus.org, with a video by the governor of Montana and lieutenant governor, a Democratic governor, Republican lieutenant governor, standing together in Montana and making clear that this ruling from the Supreme Court today will not stand, and inviting people across the nation to join the growing movement for a constitutional amendment to reclaim our democracy. You know, people need to get involved at whatever level they can, at the local, state, and federal level, to take back our democracy. And there's a movement that's happening all across this country with 300-plus resolutions being passed at the local level, with four states now on record calling for a constitutional amendment, with others yet to come. And there's much work to be done by people at the grassroots level to reclaim this Republican democracy that we cherish.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. John Bonifaz is the executive director of Free Speech for People at the website freespeechforpeople.org. And what will they find there?
They'll find a whole host of resources and a way to join this campaign and get involved at your local level. And we invite you to join us there at freespeechforpeople.org. And we invite you to circulate the video that's on our homepage just today to your friends and your neighbors to wake up the nation that we have to stand up and fight back.
John Bonifaz, thank you for being with us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow about money and politics.
Thank you so much.
You tried to buy a congressman lately? Man, I saw mine on eBay going for $1.5 million. It takes a dead president or two to purchase my favorite brew. But if money's free speech the way I hear, then bartender, where's my free beer? As both stand and sucker can see, the system's corrupt as can be. Democracy ain't diddly squat, but government has to be bought. When money talks, it rides on limo wheels. A chump change walks on rundown hills. When you suckers think that someone hears you shout, an avalanche of money drowns you out. A presidential pictures in green, they all stuffed into the money machine. Means only dead presidents vote, it's true. And they don't vote for me and you. Flows. Money, 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 you know where it goes. Money for the congressman, bags and bags of dough. Money for the senator for quid pro quo. Let's repeal hypocrisy and bring your heaven gloat. Hey, chump, unless you're filthy rich, we don't hear your vote. So welcome to the team and ranks of voters second class. Unless you feed the greed machine and kicks your sorry ass. Presidential pictures in green, they all stuffed into the money machine. That means only dead presidents vote, it's true. And they don't vote for me and you. Well, only dead presidents vote to get a clue. And they don't vote for chumps like you.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI, a non-commercial, non-corporate, listener-sponsored radio network. And that was Money in Politics, performed by Bob Malone. My name is Robert Knight, and we're now joined by Jennifer Lowenstein of the University of Wisconsin, where she is Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program. And it is so great to have you now that there is yet another president in the world today in Egypt. What is your assessment of the new Egyptian president, President Morsi?
Well, my impression is that the celebrations and all of the congratulations, these rounds of congratulations that are going around with Obama congratulating him and other people calling him up and people in the street celebrating, I find it, I understand it, but I think it's premature, and I have some very serious concerns myself. I don't know how this is going to turn out in the long run. And based on what happened over a week ago, the only thing they have to celebrate is the election of a new figurehead.
Well, the election eliminated what many people thought was an authentic modernist movement in Egypt as personified for one brief instant in time in Tahrir Square. And the Supreme Armed Forces Council eliminated, I guess, the third movement, the new movement in the attempted elections of Egypt. And we ended up with a situation where a holdover from the Mubarak regime was running against an Islamist from the Muslim Brotherhood. And do you think that was an adequate set of choices? And was there some other way to have a more representative set of candidates than ended up in the runoff?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard to say. I don't like what happened. Well, I don't think anybody I've talked to likes what happened 2 days before the last election, where the Council of the Armed Forces, the Supreme Constitutional Court, and the Electoral Commission, Election Commission, these three bodies, all representative of the old regime, stepped in and basically stripped all of the supposed gains of the last year and a half revolution as it was being talked about. They managed to strip all of the real democratic substance out of it. It's, you know, when you see that, when you realize what happened, you know, I almost feel sorry for the people who spent the last few months deeply engaged in the election. As far as did these candidates, were they enough of a choice? I don't think they were, no. I'm very surprised in many ways that there weren't other, that somehow the only two people who ran in the last election were a Muslim Brotherhood member and a member of the former Mubarak regime. The thing that is the most upsetting about that to me is that both of those candidates are representative of the old regime, of the old Egypt. Neither one of them can really be said, in my opinion, to represent a new, forward-looking, progressive Egypt. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, Mr. Morsi, has definitely made statements that have tried to be all-inclusive, that have suggested he will consider the rights of women equal. He'll also treat the Coptic Christians equally, that non-pious Muslims don't have to worry. He's made some conciliatory statements. I will give him that. But again, to me, all of this seems to be happening in a kind of sham world, because he doesn't really have any power right now. That could change. I wouldn't say we have to just give up. It's not going to change. It's, you know, this is over. I think it's premature to say that. But as things currently stand, Morsi is a figurehead. Anything that he can demand, or anything that he wants or wants to put forward, or any legislation he hopes to pass, anything he expects or wants to do in the next few weeks, for example, is ultimately not up to him. It's up to the military. And I think that there are probably a lot of Egyptians who understand that very well and are wondering, where is this going?
Well, Jennifer, one of the things that happened in the Muslim Brotherhood about 5 years ago, around 2007, 2008, there was a platform hijacking by people who would be characterized, if I'm not mistaken, as conservatives. And that is where we saw the beginnings of the platform that continued right up until these elections, mm-hmm. of excluding women.
Yes.
From positions of political responsibility,
right.
And COPTs, C-O-P-T, Coptic, right. Christians. And that was part of Morsi's debate in the early parts of the campaign. And now, overnight, with the announcement of his military appointment through the vote counting to the presidency,
yes.
He's backing off and saying, well, it may be my personal opinion, but I won't insist on that in the state. And simultaneously, there was the odd announcement that he had been dropped or was no longer a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Do I detect the hand of the United States State Department in doing a cosmetic job here?
I don't even know that the U.S. would have to. I think if the United States is involved, and I think that that's probably a fair guess that it is, that they are not really going through the Brotherhood. They're going straight to the military, and it is the military that continues to put the pressure on the Muslim Brotherhood. In many ways, the United States has dealt with the Muslim Brotherhood for a long time. It's an old player, but the power holders, the power brokers, are in the military, and there's every reason for us to assume that they are giving the orders that Washington and they already agree to. So, as you said, Morsi this morning or yesterday, he made some very conciliatory comments towards women, towards cops. He supposedly is no longer a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, but his own mentor is still in the Muslim Brotherhood, and people understand that this is a man, I'm trying to remember his name, Hayrat something, who has always been someone Morsi looks to for guidance. Is that going to stop because he's no longer a member of the Brotherhood? I doubt it. Is Morsi suddenly going to see the light and realize that women can make just as capable leaders as men? I doubt it. I think that his hand is going to be guided by the dictates of a military that has had control for a long time, that has really not gotten a new situation or anything revolutionary at all. And it's going to continue making policy. It's going to continue dictating what major decisions have to be made. And now and then they'll throw a bone to Mr. Morsi so he can look like he's actually got some kind of say in the government. That's how I see it now. Now, if there are people who are willing to protest this, and I don't mean, a few thousand, but a few hundreds of thousands of people, then perhaps there is some hope that the parliament can be restored, that the military doesn't hold an ultimate veto over any legislation that is passed. Without these changes, the whole election and all of the months leading up to it look like some kind of awful fraud.
Were you referring to Khairat el-Shater?
That's right. Khairat el-Shater. I was trying to remember
He was one of the first candidates who was disqualified. He was disqualified early on from running for the presidency under his own name. And one other question for you in regard to perspective. The United States has tremendous military involvement and years and decades of payments to Egypt to maintain some form of access there. And so it would seem to be in Washington's interest to maintain military dominance of a Supreme Council that...
It's always been in Washington's interest to maintain this. Any kind of popular representative government, any kind of real democratic rule within Egypt is against the interests of the United States, the same way that is equally true for Syria, for Yemen, for Bahrain, and for any other country in the Middle East, whether or not that country has been a traditional ally. And I think that's very important for people to understand. If any of these countries, Egypt most importantly, perhaps because it is the most populous Arab nation with 85 million people, if anything, the United States would literally be trembling in its boots, basically, if a genuine popular democracy were to come to power in Egypt. Why? Number one reason: the overwhelming majority of Egypt's people, popular opinion in Egypt, is not happy with the United States. Anti-American sentiment is the overwhelming feeling in Egypt among the people. That's also true in Syria, in Jordan, in among Palestinians, in the occupied territories, in Lebanon. So why would we want a democratic state in place? We wouldn't. Any truly democratic regime would begin to enact laws and policies that would run counter to our interests with Israel, that could, you know, why not, for example, why wouldn't Egypt want to start a warming trend with Iran? It would. In all likelihood, it would want to become on better terms with Iran. So popular opinion, the popular view, the rule of the people and the voice of the people, that's not what we want to hear. It's not what the United States can continue its own policies based on.
Finally, in the minute or two that we have left, if the military will retain ascendancy over the government and define the new constitution and the powers of the presidency, if any, there's the model in Pakistan of a strong military influence on the nominal civilian government. There's a tradition of that in Turkey nearby. What do you think the posture of the real leaders of Egypt, the Supreme Armed Forces Council, might contemplate with the belligerent foolishness that's being attempted in Syria, with what happened in Libya, and for the mobilization towards war with Iran? How do you think they'll stand up against those forces?
I'm sorry, but I'm having trouble hearing you. Could you repeat a little bit of that?
Sure. Do you think that the Egyptian military will nationalistically resist Washington's attempts to clandestinely overthrow the government in Syria and moving towards higher belligerence against Iran? How do you think the Egyptian military will respond to these pressures?
That is a very good question. My guess is that the Egyptian military will at most work on a compromise footing with the United States, because they know and we know that their future is dependent on our foreign aid, and they don't want the U.S. to withdraw foreign aid. That's, you know, that's what keeps them in power today. I can't imagine them taking risks that would put that in jeopardy, that would seriously put that in jeopardy. Not unless they had the backing of the vast majority of the Egyptian people. Now, that's possible. They could, but then they lose the funding. So it's, you know, it's a very precarious situation on the one hand. I mean, how would Egypt respond to U.S. intervention, direct intervention in Syria, for example? I don't think the average Egyptian would be very happy about it at all. But I don't think the military, the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces, would have much say in whether or not the United States went ahead and did this. They would have to sort of, you know, grit their teeth and bear it. There's nothing they could do, nothing more they could do. And I think this is the crux of the matter.
Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it today. Jennifer Lowenstein, you have been very revealing about the current mask of democracy in Egypt. Stay on that case, and we'll talk about it some more in future programs.
That mask is what they want to see there, that's for sure.
Jennifer Lowenstein, the Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we thank Michael G. Haskins for engineering today's program, and Thiago Barroso for production. And we close with this by Cannonball Adderley. It's called Mercy, Morsi, Mercy.
Mercy, 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 mercy. Thank you.